Okay, the committee will come to order. Once again, we did have a little bit of a delay there for some technical difficulties, but we're ready to go now. Trying to determine if we have a quorum. All right. We do have a quorum, and we get the approval of the minutes from January 25th. Representative Torkelson moves the approval of the minutes of January 25th. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Those fine minutes have passed once again. Today we will continue the presentations of the recipients from last session on the legacy funding, and we had hoped to have the state archaeologist here today. See how smoothly I said that word.
Good job.
Thank you. Because of yesterday, we kind of miscommunicated. He's not here, I don't believe. We will, at some point, I would hope, have someone, either the state archaeologist or someone representing him, be here. First up today, the Minnesota Children's Museum with Diane Creason, I believe. Close enough. Welcome to the committee. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yeah, thank you. Diane Creason, president of the Minnesota Children's Museum. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. In front of you, there should be a presentation from the Minnesota Children's Museum, and I'm just going to be walking through that in talking with you today. First, wanted to, before I talk specifically about the project that we've been working on with the Arts and Cultural Heritage funding, I wanted to put it in context of work within the Minnesota Children's Museum. On the first page here is a couple pictures and referencing our statewide reach as the Minnesota Children's Museum. We do serve more than 400,000 children, parents, caregivers, teachers each year, and we're proud of the fact that we reach, you know, all across the state, with 86 of the 87 counties having visitors and 43 of 87 counties having school groups that come to the museum every year. We also work very hard to keep the museum experience affordable, and in fact have 30% of our visitors come through free or reduced admissions, and we have various strategies that we do to keep that up. The Children's Museum also has many collaborations that we work on from a professional development standpoint. That's a bit of the invisible part of the museum's work, but we, as noted here, that's another place where we reach across the state, and in the last year served more than 1,500 teachers and caregivers through our programs, and they came from 35 different counties. And then also just a lot of partnerships. Partnerships with Head Start is one of the significant ways that we provide free admission to the museum, but we also have partnerships with school districts. We have partnerships with early childhood family education. We have partnerships with libraries that I'm going to touch on a little bit later as well, too. And lastly, partnerships with the community. More than 1,000 volunteers last year contributed more than 25,000 hours of service to the museum, and the picture there is actually of one of our youth volunteers. An area of our volunteering, about 30% of our volunteers are youth, the ages 14 to 18, where we provide a leadership development program for them at the same time. We have a new strategic plan at the museum, and I would love to tell you all about it, but in the interest of time, I just list our four new goals there, and I'm going to focus on the first goal, which is expanding reach. We have a bold goal to grow to 600,000 visitors. That's about a 50% growth in the next 5 years. And in fact, on the next page, I talk about that in a bit more detail, and that's a very bold goal for us. And we have a strategy that we call expanding reach through decentralized growth is our buzzword around that. What that means is we're looking to grow beyond the walls in St. Paul. We are looking to embed the learning environments. That's what we know how to do. We know how to take research and create environments where children play and have fun and learn at the same time. That is not play and learning are not oxymorons. They do go together, and especially our age-appropriate ways for children to develop in the young years. And so over this past year, we had a pilot in three libraries in the metro area where we installed an immersive learning experience designed around the six pre-emergent literacy skills that children need to learn to read and to be successful readers. And that's one way we would love to that we've done that, and we'd love to extend those and through our decentralized growth and have more environments so that we surround children, you know, throughout the state with rich learning opportunities in their communities. We're also exploring opening a children's museum in Rochester, Minnesota, a fast-growing community that does not have that resource and that cultural asset in their community, and just looking at other innovative ways to embed what we do throughout the community. So I put that in context because the work through the cultural heritage funding that we have done, that I'll start to talk about on the next page, is absolutely aligned with the same decentralized growth, and I'm proud to tell you about that work. In the last biennium, the museum was directly appropriated $500,000 for what we have done is developed an exhibit we call in the museum world that is titled Storyland, A Trip Through Childhood Favorites. In this exhibit that we're developing, and I have some props to share with you and some pictures on the next page to bring it to life, visitors step into a world of seven beloved picture books. The books are actually shown on the next page, well-loved favorites like Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, A Tale of Peter Rabbit, Where's Spot, and four other ones with that. And so what I mean by step into this world is that we create these in scale, and we create the environments and the activities and the experiences that are happening in each of these books are brought to life. So, and there's interactive components that are designed to really engage children. And while they're having fun and engaging in the exhibit, they're also developing literacy skills and a love of reading with that. We have a large-scale exhibit that we're opening, that we will open at the museum starting in September of 2011. We expect to reach about 150,000 visitors through that exhibit. And what we're doing then is three of those books then, so the large-scale exhibit will have all seven books and different activities designed around those seven books. Then we'll take three of those books, and we're creating an exhibit that would tour around Minnesota so that we can bring that experience and not have geography be a barrier, but bring that throughout greater Minnesota. Starting in July, we've identified the first three communities that the exhibit will travel to. They're listed there as Elk River, Redwood Falls, and Worthington. In April, we will issue an RFP to identify the next three communities that the exhibit will travel to. And so throughout those six cities, we anticipate reaching about 48,000 visitors throughout Minnesota. Once this is on the road and touring, we also have a formal evaluation that we're planned, where we'll have an external evaluator come in and focus on, are we achieving the learning objectives? And so, to me, the great thing is this is a cultural experience. This is something that young families can have fun in. But at the same time, there's an educational component tied into it as well, too. And so our evaluation will be focusing on that educational component. And our experiences doing as they were intended for the learning experiences for the children. And what we've also built in is some adult messaging, and is that reaching in achieving the goals that we had hoped to obtain from that as well. So those are the books. And just to give you, I also included in here just, these are some hand rendering drawings of what the exhibit looks like with that. And I just couldn't resist to also bring one prop. Peter's Snowy Day is one of the exhibits that will be there. And in Peter's Snowy Day, children will enter Peter's wintry world in which a young boy explores his neighborhood after a fresh snowfall. And so children will have dramatic play opportunities to follow Peter's track down a snowy street, discovering the sights and the sounds. It's multi-sensory, of this kind of wintry city. And in one of those activities, as he's going around town, they have an opportunity to make snow friends and to customize your own snow friend. So, for example, we create this and give our little snow friend some arms. Choose a hat for the day. You know, is it going to be that or maybe a beret or a scarf? Oh. Decide to be abandoned with the beret today, and there's mouth parts and eye parts and whatever, but so that's one of the examples of just creativity and doing your own experience with that and have an opportunity for children to have a lot of fun. Also in Peter's world, there's going to be snowflake magnetic words where you can make your own snowy magnetic poetry. In Peter Rabbit's world, there's going to be opportunities for vocabulary development, for narrative skills, while children have fun with patterns, with words, and with dramatic play. For example, in Mr. McGregor's garden, if you remember that, children will search for and find Peter's lost belongings and decorate a scarecrow. And Where's Spot is will highlight literacy development, and that begins at birth. Like the book, toddlers will have fun surprises underneath lift the flap activities on the wall. So that's just, there's lots of different interactives that are there. I just wanted to highlight a few of them that went along with that. And this diagram is, we intentionally built parent messaging into this, and this is an area that I'm particularly proud of in that the team at the museum has taken, with the advice of an advisory council, taken research on the 6 pre-emergent learning skills and translated it into language that is accessible. So whereas researchers and academics talk about print motivation and phonological awareness, I think it's much more accessible to talk about loving books and hearing sounds. And so throughout the exhibit, it's also not about sort of drilling your child into, memorizing things, but it's about how you can play with your child and what fun things you can do with rhyming to hear sounds and other activities to build those skills. And so this diagram here just shows that that'll be built into that messaging. It'll be multi-sensory. There will be graphics, but there will also be audio and other elements to bring these ideas to life, and they'll also be bilingual with that. So that is our project. I wanted to be brief with you here today. I thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you. One last thing I wanted to touch on was to talk a bit about the process and how we experienced on the process. I really have to say that we had a direct appropriation, so we worked with the Department of Administration on the contracting and the reporting on the funds. And for a new process, it has been amazing how that department staff has made it absolutely smooth for us. The staff made themselves accessible for any questions and were quickly responsive to anything associated with that. They answered all of our questions and made suggestions at times to simplify how we were, doing certain things from a tracking standpoint. And so it's extremely helpful. So, again, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity today to share our work with you. And even more so, thank you for the trust that you placed in the Minnesota Children's Museum. This project would not be possible without the funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. So on behalf of the Minnesota Children's Museum, we're honored to have the opportunity to bring Storyland to Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Ms. Kreisen. And so Storyland was basically the project that you worked on with the legacy funding.
Exactly.
And so you'll be having the opportunity to come in again and talk to us about what your plans would be for the future legacy funding. Keeping that question in mind, in terms of process, do you think that it's better to receive funding each year of the biennium or just once over the biennium?
I'm sorry, could you clarify that again?
Is it better to get money each of the 2 years or just one time?
Well, from I think depending on the project that you're doing, you know, how the funds come is, you know, I guess at some point could be a cash flow concern, you know, with that, but it's more a standpoint of, you know, what you're trying to accomplish with those funds and the total cost of what that would be involved with it. So I think that, you know, how that came 1 year versus split between 2 years, I wouldn't necessarily be concerned about.
Okay, thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us a little more about these visits to Elk River, Redwood Falls, and Worthington? Is that like at four? Are you going to have story time for an afternoon, or is it going to be over a period of time? Or could you go a little more, tell us a little more about what your vision is?
Ms. Greisen.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Great question. So yes, this exhibit will go to each of those locations, and there is we have sponsors in each of those locations, usually the Early Childhood Coalition or Early Childhood Family Education in those three cities. And they've identified a location where we will be there for 3 to 4 months. And it'll be accessible, it'll be free to families to participate and to visit it in that space. We're hoping also to augment it. I mean, obviously, with the partnership with ECFE, there'll be opportunities to connect with them and to augment the experience there. But we're also hoping and are in conversations with Reading Corps to see if there can be additional volunteer literacy development opportunities to further enrich the exhibit experience.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
then with your sponsor, then it's likely that there would be many stories, not just one story or the six stories.
Right.
Ms. Yeah. Greisen.
Thank you. There would be, these aren't, so there's three books that we created, exhibits, museum exhibits for. And so these exhibits that include, you know, I mean, I know the hand renderings are a little challenging, but, Peter Rabbit's burrow that you can walk into. And so there's physical manifestations of all these books. And so the books are brought to life and the books are present. And not just these books, but additional books, you know, augmented with it. That whole experience will be there the whole time. So children and their parents will be able to experience the exhibit and approach it in any way they want to. There isn't a scheduled story time per se, although as I was saying, we might augment that, you know, with some different activities. But the experience itself is walking in to Peter Rabbit's world and then spending an hour there and then going on to Snowy Day and experiencing there. That whole immersive experience will be in each city that we go to for 3 to 4 months and be open free of admission for children and families who want to visit during that time.
If Mr. Chair, Ms. Cassandra,
Representative Murphy,
will they have time periods? Or
Ms. Greisen,
will it be open all day or all in the evening or in the afternoon or some of all? Or that
Ms.
depends
Greisen
on the community?
Yeah, I mean, we will be working with each community in different ways. I mean, each community will have its own unique time frame depending on the space that they've selected with that. But the intent is absolutely to be available during the day for younger children who aren't in school, as well as open evenings and weekends as well, so that there is a breadth of times that people can participate in this.
And then one final question. Do you have outcomes prepared for these visits other than X number of people visited and so many visited four times or five times or whatever.
Ms.
Do you have other outcomes too?
Yeah, thank you. We have very specific educational outcomes that we hope to achieve from that and have an external evaluator that is part of the project that will be measuring, you know, some of the significant things that we're looking for along with that is our parents, are the adult messaging around the six pre-emergent literacy skills, is that effective in communicating? Is that motivating in communicating? Do parents envision themselves extending that learning beyond into the home? We've done that same messaging in the library environments that I described earlier, so as we transformed six children books areas in three libraries. We've done that evaluation for those spaces. Those used just graphics. They didn't use the audio sensory. We had great results from that, but we've now applied that learnings to this next one, but we want to continue to measure that because we think that's a very important. And frankly, this is a new thing. Children's museums, this doesn't exist of having this kind of messaging that happens in a museum experience, whereas there's a lot of research that's built into how the exhibits are created so that children learn creativity skills. They use their imagination. They build social-emotional skills, cognitive skills. And what isn't happening right now is how do you have parents understand the science behind what you're doing in really accessible ways so that's not just when you're at the museum that you can have these experiences, but you have that aha moment, you know, where you can take that beyond the home. So while this is important for us for literacy per se, we really want to ladder this up to have a bigger learning that comes out of here of how do we help children or how do we help parents really understand, you know, ways to develop and fun ways to play with their kids to develop their skills.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kreisen. Appreciate your presentation, and we'll see you again later.
Thanks.
Next, we have the Science Museum of Minnesota. Tom Murphy and Brenda Rainey. I want this phonetically. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Brenda Rainey from the Science Museum of Minnesota. I'm the Director of Government Relations there. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come today and tell you about what we've done with the generous allocation we received from this committee last biennium. So to start, I should thank you for that allocation. We received $900,000 from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Funding. And I just, you know, want to say that as the most visited museum in Minnesota, we're already a cultural icon for a lot of Minnesotans, but we really wanted to take this money and use it to get out to other corners of the state, bring the museum to people who maybe aren't here in St. Paul, and also increase the size of and access to our collections of Minnesota cultural heritage artifacts that we have here in St. Paul. What I'm going to be talking about today mirrors very closely the packet that you'll have in the, I believe, right pocket of the folder that you were given. And the first project I'm going to talk about is an American Indians collection project. So we used part of our initial appropriation from the legacy funding to purchase a 191-piece collection of regional American artifacts dating from approximately 1830 to 1910. And this collection is, in itself, of high scholarly value. Researchers have studied it in the past, and we fully expect them to continue studying it in the future. But what we felt was the true value of purchasing this collection, what I think this committee will think is the true value, is that it's now remaining intact and in Minnesota for perpetuity. The staff that brokered this purchase is quite confident that had the Science Museum not been able to step up with sufficient funding to purchase the entire collection at one time, that this certainly would have been broken up, sold off to individual collectors, and ended up in private hands around the country, perhaps around the world. And now it's going to be here in St. Paul. We're using our state-of-the-art conservation and storage facilities to be sure that it's well taken care of and available to the public. And I'm excited to talk about an MHS, Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund grant that we received last June. that is going to be for a collaborative project that the Science Museum and the Minnesota Historical Society will embark on together to increase access to our joint American Indian collections from this time period. Between our two institutions, we have about 500 of these objects, and together with this grant, we're going to work on digitizing images of the objects, making them available online, doing deeper object research, doing oral history prototype interviews of contemporary voices commenting on the importance of these objects, and developing an online educational tool. And I think that this project really shows the power of these legacy dollars. By capitalizing on the expertise that we each have at our own individual institutions and sharing the project between the two of us, we're going to be able to do far more in a cost-effective way than we would be if each of us tried to embark on this project on our own. We'll be sharing expertise, we'll be sharing technology, and we'll be getting more done. The second project that I want to talk about today is something that we call Suitcase Science. And I have a prototype book from Suitcase Science that I don't know if some members might be interested in looking at. You can just pass it around. Thank you. As some of you know, the Science Museum of Minnesota was a pioneer in the museum theater world. Back in 1971, 40 years ago, we started using theater on the museum floor as a way to interpret themes and for museum visitors in different ways than they might have been used to. So with this legacy money, we took some of that and our expertise in museum theater to develop a new theater piece with a different twist. And this piece is a collection of stories that blend science and culture as told by objects that have been identified as important by Minnesotans throughout the state. We had museum staff travel to sites in five greater Minnesota cities, as well as throughout the metro area, and host workshops that were open to the public. Participants in the workshops would bring in an object, and as a group, they would go through exercises specifically designed to help them tell the story about why that object was important to them. Museum staff recorded these stories and took photos of the objects and the people who were there. Back in the office, they researched science-related components of each of these objects and then blended the individual stories with the science facts to create a single narrative that each object shares. Tangible outcomes of this project include the book that's being passed around that includes stories and photos from all of the sites that we visited, as well as a theater piece in which a narrator assumes the voice of each of these objects as he or she picks them up and shares their stories with a live audience in the museum. I think that this project achieves, in a really wonderfully unique way, the goal from the legacy funds of reaching out and engaging communities and cultural experiences across the state, and also the Science Museum's goal of increasing science literacy by showing the presence of science in everyday objects. We know that neither of these disciplines operates in a vacuum, but this project blends art and science, culture, and community in a seamless way. To date, we've collected over 300 stories from communities across the state, and over 6,500 people have seen the Suitcase Science production here in St. Paul. The production is put on at least once a day here in the Science Museum, but we're heading back out to each of these community sites in April. And at that time, we're going to deliver two copies of each of these books in their final form, as well as perform site-specific productions based on the objects from these different communities. We're bringing two copies of the books. We're leaving them in libraries in each of these communities. One copy will be available for checkout. One copy will be held at the library for all times for people to come in and look at. We're also in the process of launching an online component of this project where somebody could participate in Suitcase Science virtually. They could upload a photo of themselves with one of their objects and fill out a questionnaire about the object, talking about why it's important to them. And our staff at the museum will then turn that into one of the stories similar to what you see in the book. Evaluation is key at the Science Museum of Minnesota. We're fortunate enough to have an in-house evaluation team that works on all of our programs and projects, as well as evaluating our visitor satisfaction. And comments from the evaluation of this program include sayings like, this is the kind of thing that brings different people together to find out what we have in common. And more simply, a great community building experience. And I think those comments really go to the heart of what the legacy money was intended for, bringing Minnesotans together for a rich and a personal cultural experience in their own communities. The last program that I want to talk a little bit about today is something called interactive video conferencing. And I'm going to abbreviate that to IVC. We allocated some of our appropriation from the legacy funding to explore the option to invest in IVC equipment sufficient to produce high-quality, collections-based outreach experiences. We did a very thorough analysis of best practices for program development, what kind of technology we would need to purchase, business and sustainability models for programs like this. As we went through that process, we came to the realization that IVC was probably not the best way the Science Museum of Minnesota could most cost-effectively increase our presence in greater Minnesota communities. So we are currently in the process of reallocating the dollars we had originally intended to spend on those purchases into these two other projects that I've just talked about, and we're also exploring other opportunities to more effectively and efficiently partner with non-metro audiences, especially schools. So that sums up the three programs that we've implemented with our legacy appropriation from 2 years ago, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Ms. Rainey, that last comment that you just said, especially schools, have you explored working through community education?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, specifically, I am not sure. We've got a community relations and outreach department that's primarily in charge of all of our community outreach work. I could easily go back and find out what kind of contacts they've had with community education groups.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Rainey, I'd be interested in learning about that because I think community education is supposed to be providing something for people of all ages in the community, mm-hmm. and I think it seems to me the older people get, the more interested in science they are, and perhaps they should remember what it was like being a child and the wonder of it all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy.
Ms. Rainey.
It's a keen observation, and you're absolutely correct, and I'd be happy to look into what we're doing there.
Ms. Rainey, who owns the American Indian Collection?
Mr. Chair, the 191-piece collection that I referred to is currently owned by the Science Museum of Minnesota. We're on a payment plan that runs through, in its original contract, runs through December of 2011. With the reallocation of that IVC project money, we're in the process of renegotiating that contract, and we're hopefully going to be paying that off earlier.
Okay. Other questions of Ms. Rainey? Are all counties visiting the Science Museum?
Mr. Chair, we have visitor representation from every county, and the booklet that's on the left-hand pocket of the folder, the inside back cover of that booklet shows a map showing our field trip and school outreach attendance throughout the state.
Thank you, Ms. Rainey. So Lake of the Woods County did make it?
You know, I can't Lake of the Woods County makes it as a visitor. And it looks like Lake of the Woods County had school outreach vans traveling to that county and presenting Science Museum programs in the schools there.
Well, that's I was worried about them. But, Ms. Rainey, last year, a school district that I represent, Dassel-Cocato, spent an overnight there. Mm-hmm. And I was pleased to join them for part of that and felt you did a fine job in presenting things. I didn't stay overnight with them, but I did eat pizza with them.
You were scared.
Yes.
I heard you had a cheeseburger.
Well, Representative Dill, that's not true, is it? pizza, but I'm no longer talking about cheeseburgers, Representative Dill.
Can someone please record that?
No, it's now become the bacon cheeseburger because I feel I've been neglecting pork producers.
Thank you.
So, but thank you. Thank you, Representative Dill. Any other questions of Ms. Rainey? Thank you, then.
Thank you.
We'll be having you back again later. Welcome to the committee. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Michelle Furr. I'm the campus manager and director of Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. First off, on behalf of Como, I'd like to thank you for your previous and past support. The programs that I'm going to share with you today that were funded and supported through the Legacy Amendment Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund would have not been possible without your support. Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is one of the top visited cultural destinations in the state of Minnesota, welcoming over 2 million visitors each year because it's free, accessible, interactive, welcoming for families, and we celebrate diversity amongst many forms across cultures, ethnicities, economics, and generations. And our visitors come from all over the state of Minnesota. 16% just come from the city of St. Paul, but about 60% are from the metro area, which represents 40% that comes from outstate and out of state. Here are the programs Como funded as part of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Fund. And we had four different categories of exhibits and interactives and interpretives. And you have a packet in your folders that also goes through some of the breakdown of the exhibits that we funded, as well as some of the photos that I have up here today. As a core to Como's mission on education, updating the aging interpretive and signage and adding interactive and technology-based hands-on experience is important to us. The new educational and interactive displays use the latest technology to present engaging presentations to increase the interest, awareness, and knowledge in our users. While the primary emphasis is to enhance the existing rapport between our guests and our animal habitats, there's an opportunity for us to present information on an educational nature that helps the public better understand the animals, their physical characteristics, their needs, their global origins, global region of origins, and the ongoing conservation efforts that Como participates in. We focused on two different animal areas. Here in the photos that you see is our primate building. We had the opportunity to leverage the funds from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Amendment with our nonprofit partner, Como Friends, that funded. And as I go through the slides, I'll show you some of the leveraging that we were able to do with that. So on top of the interpretive graphics that you see here, we were also able to add some sound-absorbing panels, some overhead forest canopies, some additional interactive displays, and some lighting enhancements. The primate building was complete in June, in July, and in June we're going to be opening a new area in our marine mammal building. This area will focus on our oceans and our commitment to conservation of oceans. It will have a large video panel in the background, and in the foreground we'll have an interactive interpretive, this is coral reef, that will have some displays around it on a ring. And that will be complete in June of 2011. Creating connections with Como's animals, plants, and gardens that foster appreciation, conservation, and preservation are part of Como's core values. One way we are able to make these connections is through interactive opportunities such as our daily keeper talks, story time, and our famous Sparky the Sea Lion shows. Utilizing the Legacy Amendment Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds, Como Zoo developed and produced a fun and educational performance called Creature Feature that was presented daily Memorial Day through September, providing our audiences with another additional opportunities to be entertained while they learn about our animals, our training, and our care.
We reached almost 300,000 guests just in the creature feature shows this summer. Como Zoo was able to offer blooming butterflies a special exhibit in 2010 by the support of the Legacy Amendment Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Hundreds of butterflies from Africa, Asia, North, Central, and South America flied freely in an indoor temporary exhibit among tropical plants in a lush garden environment at Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. Guests learned about their native habitats, their life cycles, and the importance they place on the ecosystem. You can see a young lady with her butterfly in her leg there. While Como is a natural setting with living art exhibits, it also houses many works of art, as well as been an inspiration for many budding artists. These exhibits offer unique opportunities that are above the standard zoo visit. So offering temporary and traveling exhibits that include areas in art, animal, and plant life. Como Zoo has had the ability to utilize these funds to produce and introduce up to 3 shows, one that just closed called The Up Close and Personal, A Journey into the World of Insects from Their Perspective, a photo exhibit featuring ultra-close-up macro photography. And that's what you see. It's a bee. I don't know why it doesn't show the bottom picture there, but it's a horned bee and a fly you see on the side there. We have a large gallery space that we can house. There was about 60 different photographs from that collection. We're also planning an African cats exhibit that will open this spring that will be partnering with not only a local museum but also a national conservation organization called APCRO, and an edible garden that will also open this spring. Ribbit Zibbit. This is a new frog conservation exhibit that will be permanently housed in our children's gallery. Como will offer 4 threatened frog species using this exhibit that will open in March. 1/2 to 1/3 of all amphibian species are threatened with extinction across the world. Como's new frog exhibit will teach and inspire guests about one of the greatest and most urgent conservation undertakings ever, the preservations of frogs and amphibians. Como has participated in a variety of conservation programs with these animals for many years. This exhibit will give us an opportunity to highlight our work to the public and put a spotlight on forward action plans for certain species like the Wyoming toad and the Panamanian golden frog. These 4 exhibits will be presented in Como's Children's Gallery and will incorporate not just the living animals, but also interactives and plants that were geared mostly for our youth volunteers and visitors. So the use of funds that we were appropriated as part of the Arts and Cultural Heritage, the 2010 and 2011 piece was shared amongst the zoo, and then there was a competitive grant piece, so that's why you see the 2010 number a little bit higher. In the white, you see that $87,000 was money that we were able to leverage through additional grants and partnerships, including our nonprofit partner. And the breakdown of our expenditures, you can see where we spent those additional pieces on the interpretive graphics for our primate building and along with blooming butterflies. We had quite a few measurable outcomes with our use of the funds, and we were able to manage to meet most of them. Some were based on attendance, but also on guest perception. One of the other outcomes is that we wanted to make sure that we were able to incorporate educational experiences, not just to the guests, but also through volunteerism and internships. As part of Blooming Butterflies, we were able to offer 13 internship opportunities to area college students, as well as 28 interpreter volunteer programs. And between the two, they had donated over 4,000 hours of volunteerism. As you can see, Como Park Zoo and Conservatory has been able to allocate the Legacy Amendment Arts and Culture Heritage Funds for a variety of impactful programs, reaching millions of Minnesotans, and all would not be possible without your support. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fear. A past Representative Seifert, used to express a lot of concern about one of your species there. How are the gorillas doing?
The gorillas?
Yeah.
We have 2 male bachelor gorillas, and we are in the process. We're just finishing up the design work for their new habitat that will be in construction in late 2011 and will open in 2013. And this new habitat will offer a number of opportunities for the 2 gorillas that we have, as well as have the ability to house a family group. So the gorillas are doing very well. Thank you.
Good to hear that, because I know there was concern about homeless gorillas, and your habitat is, I think, worthwhile.
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Well, you're getting off easy. Thank you. Next, we have Minnesota Public Television. Bill Straczynski and Les Heen. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourselves, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Les Heen, and I'm the general manager and president of Pioneer Public Television in Appleton, and appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Straczynski. I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television. It's my pleasure to be here with you as well.
You may proceed.
First of all, I would like to thank the voters of Minnesota who made the legacy amendment possible, and also the members of the legislature who have shown their support for the Minnesota Public Television Association through these appropriations. We also appreciate the work with the Department of Administration. The department has been quite good to work with throughout this process. The Minnesota Public Television Association's six stations received a total of $6.3 million over the biennium. And as a refresher, I know you've got some of this information, but the six stations are include the one where I work in Appleton, Minnesota, and we have towers near Worthington and Fergus Falls, so we cover western and west central Minnesota. There is the Austin station, which covers the communities of Austin, Albert Lea, and Rochester. Lakeland Public Television, which is Bemidji, Brainerd. Duluth Public Television. We also have Prairie Public Television in the Fargo-Moorhead, Crookston area. And we have Twin Cities Public Television as well. And I should add that with me today, we also have from Twin Cities Public Television, we have Ahua Hoffman and Diane Steinbach and Terry O'Reilly are here as well on behalf of Twin Cities Public Television. Now, in a moment, we're going to show you a short clip, and that's a clip to give you an example of the hundreds of hours that we've broadcast in the past year. The clip will just take just a few minutes. But I should add that the six stations all have done something different because they're all independent, nonprofit, community-based organizations. And what that means is that we listen to our communities and we act on what our communities believe are the important issues and the stories we should present. We've asked our communities for ideas about what sort of stories we should do with legacy funding. And we've applied those ideas in ways that we believe emphasizes transparency and accountability for the funds we've received. For example, we asked advisory committees and viewers for input. We've developed programs that reflect community ideas about arts, history, and cultural heritage. And we put the programs online so that anyone, anytime, can watch our programs. Even if they miss it when it's broadcast, they can watch it online. And we've produced work plans and reports that provide for transparency and accountability. And we've made the commitment to keep these programs online. And that's important for future use. So schools can have access to them, other people can have access to them online at any time. Now that's a quick outline of what we've done, but I think with that it's best that we show you some of what we've done, and that's why we've got a video. So if this works, right, we just hit play, right? Here we go. Coming up? Okay.
This program is funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, with money from the vote of the people of Minnesota on November 4th, 2008.
Now, that announcement that you heard at the end in the logo there, that's an example. We've just started using the logo because, of course, that came out in just the last few weeks. So we started using the logo on programs already. And I'd like to add that if you would like a longer version of that, we have something special planned on Thursday, March 24th from 7 to 10 p.m. And in that three-hour block, all of the stations that you saw listed there are going to broadcast legacy programming for an entire evening. Each of the stations has provided a half-hour program into that three-hour block. So that'll be a chance for people all over the state on one evening to get a sample of what we've done with legacy funding. So that Celebrate Minnesota name that you saw is what's going to be on that program again, Thursday, March 24th from 7 to 10 p.m. I mentioned a minute ago that, of course, all of the stations go through their own process to determine ideas of what stories they should do. Let me just give an example of how that's worked at Pioneer, because I think it's similar to other stations. We asked our community advisory board members, we asked the people that we work with in our communities, what are some of the stories and things that we should do? What are the things that are important to our area? And one of the things that they said was that a big part of western Minnesota is working and living outdoors, from farming to fishing, and that that's an important part of our culture and our heritage and our history and our art. So one of the first things we did was we knew we'd do stories about agriculture. And that led us to do a story on a wonderful history piece about the Morris Minnesota Farm Exposition of 1913 and what that meant to that community. And also a story about the history of turkey farming, which put us into Representative Erdahl's area. So not too far from you, that story was done near Litchfield, as I recall.
You're not referring to any of my constituents, are you?
Not by name, sir. Our community members also said that the history of natural resources were important. So we've done stories about local parks. We showed the park stories to some community members afterwards, too, because we wanted to say, was this what you had in mind? Is this the sort of thing that you would like us to do? And they said that after watching some of the stories about the history of the local parks, they would go see some parks that they'd never visited before, even though they were only an hour or two away. Local artists have also told us that they made a difference. One of the first clips you saw there was, you may have seen a hand moving on some rose mulling. And that artist said that in her small town, she sold art to a customer from Colorado. And the customer had watched a segment on a website, on one of our websites, and had come through and made a different trip on her way home from Wisconsin, going through Minnesota to Colorado so she could stop there and buy art from that artist. So we're making a difference for the artist in economic development. And our community members also told us that our region's history of community and military service was important. And that's why we produced Honor Flight Southwest Minnesota. There were about 100 veterans from southwestern Minnesota that traveled to Washington, D.C. And the local communities in five counties of southwestern Minnesota raised the money to send those veterans. And we had the chance to go along on that trip. We filmed their stories before, during, and after the trip. And when we finished the documentary, just a couple of months after we put most of it together, we worked with the people in Laverne, Worthington, Pipestone, Jackson, Slayton, those communities, and around there, and we hosted a special premiere. So those veterans got to get them back together one more time and share the experience of watching what they had done and where they'd been. And what was really neat about that was a lot of the veterans said, we didn't know the stories of the other veterans because we were only together on a trip to Washington, D.C. But because of the legacy-funded public television program on this documentary, we saw the stories of the other veterans. Now, in the months since we aired that program, we know that some of those veterans have passed away. And we're grateful, very grateful for the opportunity to have done those programs and to recorded their personal histories, not only for our viewers, but also for their family and community members. And that was a great partnership with the Honor Flight organizers in southwestern Minnesota. Finally, I know that you have a report that details some of the production work from MPTA stations and has additional numbers, including information such as the 37 jobs made possible by the amendment, lists of stories, descriptions of program, diversity, educational efforts, and a lot more, and you also have an executive summary. So with that, again, I'd like to thank you for your support and your interest, and I also know that Bill Straczynski has some additional information, and we'd welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Heen. Maybe I'll just ask a question to two of you first before Mr. Straczynski starts. I caught some debates in the from the last legislative campaign on your stations. Just wondering, you know, how many state senate, how many state house? Do you happen to know how many debates were featured?
I think we invited candidates in 21 races, and I think we had about 14 or 15 debates. Because okay. not every race that you invite do you get a debate, but I think we had 14 or 15. I could get you the list.
Okay, just I thought it was valuable to me. I was not, but that was fine. But also, just wanted to comment. I tried to get with Representative Murphy jogging my memory a little bit, but I thought, you know, an example of melding some of these things a little bit. We did provide some funding for helping to revitalize Native language, Ojibwe language, and maybe some Dakota. And then I notice here that you had a documentary on First Speakers restoring the Ojibwe language. And I think that's an example of how, you know, different funds, you know, can come together with one project. So I just wanted to make that point. Anyone have any questions of Mr. Heen before we go on with Mr. Straczynski? Mr. Straczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, again, I'm Bill Straczynski, representing the Friends of Minnesota Public Television. We made commitments to you 2 years ago about what we would do with the legacy dollars. But before we begin, I've got a question. Do you think it's appropriate if we could use legacy dollars for political debates? We don't, just so you know. But they are preserved for posterity purposes in our archives. But in any event, the report is pretty detailed. There's 54 pages worth of material, right down to the particular programs that we produced, each station, what they did with their dollars, each segment. And we worked hard to, from an accountability perspective, to provide common definitions and common themes. So you'll see our report deals with our commitments, each station's commitment to diversity, education, community outreach, partnerships and collaborations and what have you. And I won't take you through that. There's a couple of page report about each station that may be in your own individual area. I invite you to take a look at those particular pages. The executive summary does highlight a few of the documentaries we've produced in public television, some of the new weekly series, not all of them, but some highlights on some of that. But I think I want, again, you talked about outcomes and the commitments we made to this legislature, the legislature 2 years ago. We did, and a review of those outcomes I think are important. First of all, we did create 37 jobs in public television specifically related to legacy programming. They produced over 121 hours of legacy programs and broadcast so far, over 602 hours of programs. Featured over 1,161 individual artists, 674 art historians, or historians, educators, and experts in certain fields. We've collaborated and worked with 200 different organizations in the past 18 months to bring their ideas forward. We've had 35 partners and collaborators on specific projects, including the Minnesota Historical Society and local historical societies. And again, along with our commitment to the legislature, we did produce so far 84 lesson plans and activity guides that educators can use. We've had over 336,000 web page views so far, and we have over 106 hours of worth of programming available in each individual station's for review by the public at any time. Those programs are all archived there. That's important because while we reach 2 million people watch us each week on your local public television stations, that's really important. They can go back later on and use those. Educators can use those programs for many years to come. They'll always be archived in an individual station. So I think that's really important. And finally, at the bottom of the executive handout, executive summary of our report, is the stations are listed along with their individual websites. Mr. Chairman, I know we'll talk in the future about our ask, and one of the things we want to do is put together one website so it's a little bit easier. And for work, in fact, we're working with and have offered to LCC to provide video to their website, and we offered to help them with some specific things that relates to public television and make it easier accessible to the public. Public television has been receiving grants from the state of Minnesota going back to the mid-70s and early 70s, in fact. I can personally attest to that because I've been around that long, Mr. Chairman. And we're familiar with transparency and accountability. And I think it's important to note, and I know how important this issue was to everybody the last couple of sessions, and it's extremely important to you as you move forward. We worked with the Department of Administration early on in contract language so that we could be held accountable, responsible for that. We've always provided audited financial statements and those kinds of things. Our plans are on file. Our plans are viewable on the websites of the LCC, how much we spend, how it was spent, and all of those kinds of details. We're comfortable in that kind of environment, and we think it's good. But the Department of Administration worked very hard in putting together the contract language, which we found very comfortable in working with, and we do present and submit quarterly reports. There are a couple of legislative issues, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you want to get into that now or later, that we talked about. We have some concerns with the legislation that exists today. We'd like to see some tweaks in the legislation. I'll just tell you what they are, Mr. Chairman, very easily.
Mr. Straczynski, we won't get into a involved discussion today on it, but you can bring up the points and we'll discuss it further when you come back the next time.
Fine. I think just very quickly, we have some trouble with the statutory language as it relates to production rights and distribution, because we have been getting the rights to a song like the Beatles that broadcast over the air. We can't use that. We don't have the rights to that song to be downloaded on our websites. So we want to tweak with that language a little bit to make it the language and the statute specifically reflect what our real world is. We also would like to discuss in the future, certainly, it's called administrative fees, but to us it's really overhead. It may be different for other organizations like the arts or what have you, or its arts board. But overhead cost is 2.5%. We'd like to see an expansion of that, and I'll share some further ideas with you on things that we just are not covered, and I'd like to share that with you. But finally, Mr. Chairman, I think a wise person once told me, as we're thinking about this stuff and appropriations to public television, you know, we're owned by you. We're owned by the communities we serve. And if you take a look at it as an equity investment, think about your contributions to us as an equity investment, and look at the kind of return on an investment that you really get for the dollars that are invested. Not just the fact we created a lot of jobs and what have you, but the dollars you invested with us. We secure other partners, secure other dollars, and we provide community right to our own programming to our own community and to all our members throughout the state of Minnesota. Everyone in Minnesota has taken advantage of public television programming, and everyone in Minnesota has taken advantage of the programming available through the legacy dollars. And we know hundreds of thousands of people have certainly seen it on the web. I think that's an impressive return on your investment for the equity dollars you've contributed to us. So I'd like to think you to think about that way as we go forward when we get specifically to our ask for appropriations in the future. Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's the end of my remarks, unless you have comments.
Thank you, members. Questions of either Mr. Heen or Mr. Straczynski. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any part of Minnesota that does not receive public television being broadcasted to their homes?
Mr. Straczynski.
Mr. Chairman, public television over the air. You can turn on a television, your television, and get a signal, and 97% of the public can see that signal. However, we are available 100% of the public with our signal because they have cable or something like that in the areas where we don't have a transmitter that doesn't quite reach that little area. But 100% of the people do get our public television signal now in Minnesota in a digital environment.
Following up on that, Mr. Straczynski, does everyone get the Minnesota channel?
Mr. Chairman, yes, everybody is available to everybody in Minnesota, as far as I know, unless there's one of the satellite providers that's not carrying it. But I think we've remedied some of those situations in the past year.
Well, Mr. Straczynski, I know that we did with, I believe, DirecTV. No, I can't remember which one.
DirecTV, Mr.
I'm afraid that one of them may still not be carrying, but I could be wrong. I think Dish Network isn't. Or is. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes. I'm not sure which
one. Let's double check on that when you come back and...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know which one it is. It's Dish Network. DirecTV is now carrying the Minnesota channel on its we did install some equipment, so they now pick up our signal. But under the common carriage rules of the FCC, it's a federal requirement, they carry local public television stations on their channels. It's not, that's a different agreement with the federal government and satellite carriers. They're a little bit different than hardwired cable into individual homes. So the Dish Network, it's something that they have to hopefully volunteer to do with carry the Minnesota channel someday.
All right, thank you. Other questions?
Thank you for investment in us.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you again later. And we have one more presentation today.
Ampers and Ely.
I believe we have the Ampers presentation. Late breaking news, members. The state archaeologist has shown up. So after this, we'll have a short presentation from him. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Erdahl. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I'm the Executive Director of Ampers.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Michelle Jansen. I'm the President of Ampers and Station Manager for Jazz 88 KBEM.
Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Chairman Erdahl and members of the committee. We'd like to begin by first and foremost thanking you for not only inviting us here today, but also for providing us the funding that allowed us to increase the amount and the quality of the arts and cultural heritage programming that we provide to the local communities we serve across Minnesota. All of you should have received our formal presentation electronically. We do have additional copies of that for you if you don't have that with you. We're going to go through a much more abridged version of that today, which is was in your packet of information today and will be part of our PowerPoint. Ampers, which provides diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, is made up of 12 community-based radio stations around Minnesota. We are not affiliated with, nor do we receive any funding from Minnesota Public Radio. Each Ampers station is licensed directly to a college, school, or university, or licensed directly to the community that it serves. The Ampers stations include WTIP-FM in Grand Marais. My apologies here, we're not wanting to cooperate. There we go. We'll just do it this way. WTIP in Grand Marais, which covers Grand Marais, Grand Portage, the Gunflint Trail, and is licensed directly to the community. KAXE, which serves Grand Rapids, Bemidji, and Brainerd, and is also licensed directly to the community. KSRQ up in Thief River Falls is licensed to Northland Community College, Community and Technical College, excuse me. KUMD-FM covers the Duluth metro area and is affiliated with the University of Minnesota Duluth. KVSC broadcast signal covers the greater St. Cloud area and is licensed to St. Cloud State University. The four stations here in the Twin Cities include Jazz 88, affiliated with the Minneapolis Public Schools, KUOM, Radio K at the University of Minnesota, which is licensed to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and KFAI and KMOJ, which are both community licensed stations. In southern Minnesota, we have KMSU covering the Mankato and Austin area from Minnesota State University, Mankato, and KQAL at Winona State University. Because Minnesota Public Radio and Ampers are both public radio stations, understandably, there's a fair amount of confusion. The two serve very different audiences, very different needs, and operate in very different ways. The Ampers stations are smaller community radio stations. Each station only has between 2 to 14 employees on staff, with many of them relying primarily on volunteers. The Ampers stations are not rebroadcasting or retransmitting programming from one main station. Each station is individually programmed to meet the needs of their community. The stations all have their own local management and board of directors to ensure they are truly serving the needs of their community on a grassroots level. As a result, we have programs in 12 different languages, as well as local public affairs, diverse programming, and diverse music. The stations also have significant educational programs ranging from formal broadcast classes to hands-on training for community volunteers. Ampers itself is an association designed to help support Minnesota's community radio stations. 11 of the 12 stations receive funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. KUMM in Morris does not qualify because of its size. As you're probably aware, the Department of Management and Budget directed the Department of Administration to create grant agreements with each of our stations. Each station submits a proposal with specifics on how they will spend their portion of the funding. The Department of Administration then reviews and has to approve each proposal prior to distributing the funds. In addition, AMPR stations are bound by Minnesota Statute 129.19, which is also in your packet of information. Now that you have a better understanding of AMPRs and the process by which the state monitors our spending, I'm going to turn it over to President Jansen to share the more enjoyable task of sharing some of the exciting legacy programs that we've developed.
Thank you, Joel. Chairman Erdahl, members of the committee, again, my name is Michelle Jansen, and again, I'm a station manager for Jazz 88 KBEM here in the Twin Cities, and I'm also president of AMPRs. I'm proud to report that in 2010, AMPRs and its member stations created more than 1,600 different legacy programs on a variety of arts, nature, history, and cultural topics, ranging from KSRQ's free concert in Thief River Falls with Polka Ron and the Swingin' Bobcats to KQAL's Culture Click, a program that creates awareness and understanding of Winona's diversity. AMPRs created and covered arts and culture across the entire state of Minnesota. Our programs took listeners to 64 of Minnesota's 87 counties in 2010.
Ms. Jansen, if I may interrupt, there seems to be a hole in the middle of the state, right around Meeker County there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I will be addressing that in just a moment.
Oh, thank you.
As we continue to develop more programs, we're looking to showcase topics in the remaining 23 counties, including a story about the world's largest twine ball. In the event we are fortunate enough to receive legacy funds in the next biennium, we are also talking with the Historical Society about a documentary for the anniversary of the 1862 conflict. The AMPR stations have always been committed to enhancing arts and culture in Minnesota, but the additional funding has allowed us to take that commitment to the next level. Perhaps the best example is the partnership we created with the Minnesota Historical Society to create MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds. The history feature airs twice a day, Monday through Friday, on all 12 stations, everything from sports, politics, and agriculture to business, weather, and pop culture in Minnesota. It delivers Minnesota history statewide in a very fun and entertaining way.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
It's baseball season, and there are four little words pitchers love to hear.
Strike three, you're out!
A slider is a very effective tool for striking out batters. It's like a curveball, but with extra speed. The National Baseball Hall of Fame credits Charles Albert Bender, a Minnesotan, with inventing the slider.
He was always thinking of new ways to get hitters out.
That's Minnesota author Tom Swift. He recently wrote a biography about Bender. Charles Albert Bender was an Ojibwe born in 1884 on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. He learned to play baseball when he was forced to live at a boarding school in Pennsylvania. Bender's major league career included 212 wins and a shutout in the 1905 World Series.
Early in Bender's career, he developed a reputation for being a pitcher who performed his best when his team needed him most.
Swift says, as great a player as Bender was, he rarely got the respect he deserved.
Prejudice and racism were overt forces that he was facing every day of his life.
In 1953, just a year before his death, Bender became the first Minnesotan elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. It would be nearly 50 years before another Minnesotan, Dave Winfield, would join him there.
MN90 is a co-production of the Minnesota Historical Society and AMPRs, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, online at mn90.org.
We are now working with the Historical Society to make the MN90 segments available to teachers statewide for use in the classrooms. In order to maximize taxpayers' dollars and give even more Minnesotans access to all the AMPRs legacy programming, we used some of the funds to create an elaborate infrastructure to share and archive the programs. Since its creation in late January of 2010, stations have accessed this new system of sharing more than 1,200 times to air programs created by AMPRs or one of its member stations. We also relaunched our website, AMPRs.org, in July to archive all of our legacy programs. There is a very small sample of what you'll find there.
Ampers stations were busy last year, creating more than 1,600 radio stories, documentaries, and concerts.
From KQAL in Winona, Don't You Know.
People,
Don't You Know.
Places,
Don't You Know.
Events,
Don't You Know.
From the campus of Winona State University, KQAL FM is proud to present
Don't You Know.
Now, here with Everything Winona, here's Terry Tenseth.
Oh, Don't You Know.
From KMOJ in Minneapolis-St. Paul, the history of gospel in Minnesota.
This is the history of gospel in Minnesota.
Hello everyone, I'm Mitch Faulkner, and welcome to the history of gospel music in Minnesota.
From KAXE in Grand Rapids, Ojibwe Mohan, an Ojibwe language program.
Ani Ginani Nishinakazoyan.
Mitch Clumsy Indishinakaz.
Andi and Dian.
Gamasquawako Kog, Minawabamajigamog.
From KFAI in Minneapolis-St. Paul, 10,000 Fresh Voices.
How do you know if something is flarf or just bad poetry?
Well, it depends on who wrote it.
From KMSC in Mankato, the Mankato Symphony Orchestra. From KBEM Jazz 88 in Minneapolis-St. Paul, What's Real? A series featuring essays by Minneapolis high school students.
This is Phong Pham at Washburn High School. I am Vietnamese. Usually my mom cooks Vietnamese food to eat, but on Thanksgiving Day, it's a very special occasion. It's the day of the year that we only cook American food, and everyone in the family contributes to make the food.
From KBSC in St. Cloud, Monday Night Live, a Minnesota music show.
Well, I'm in the background, and you can't find me.
From WTIP in Grand Marais, Field Notes.
Gulls finally are coming down. Just one at a time right now.
From KUMD in Duluth, Radio Gallery, a Minnesota-focused arts program.
People like to do dioramas because it's not a well-respected art form, because it's not scary to do a diorama. It's something that people did when they were kids.
From Radio K in Minneapolis-St. Paul, Culture Q, the art show that rocks.
Do you know what the Cinco de Mayo is?
Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May. I don't really know, actually.
It's a celebration for Independence Day in Mexico.
Cinco de Mayo is not Mexican Independence Day.
From KSRQ in Thief River Falls, Saturday Morning Barn Dance Christmas Party. Support for these shows comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
And again, we're looking to showcase topics in the remaining 23 counties in the next biennium, hopefully. In addition to broadcasting the more than 1,600 stories, documentaries, and concerts on the radio stations and making them all available on ampers.org, Ampers took yet another step to make the arts more accessible to Minnesotans. We produced and are in the process of distributing 5,000 CDs and 2,000 download cards that include a sample of some of the best legacy programs. We've got them right over here if you want to take one on your way out today. The stations and the Historical Society are distributing them free of charge. And through a partnership with the Metropolitan Library Service Agency and the Council of Regional Library System Administrators, citizens will be able to check them out from their local library. We also have copies with us today for any committee members or anybody else in attendance who'd like one. We realize partnerships are strongly encouraged. The individual stations have created dozens of them. We don't have time to mention all of them, but you'll find more information about the partnerships on page 16 of our full report. It's also worth mentioning that KMOJ used some of its legacy funding to pay part of the cost of a new transmitter, dramatically increasing the number of people who can now hear the arts and culture programs on that station. Prior to that upgrade, the station could only reach residents in Hennepin and portions of Anoka and Ramsey counties. As you can see, the signal now reaches all of Hennepin, Anoka, Ramsey, Dakota, and Washington counties. The signal has increased from 352 square miles to more than 2,000 square miles, giving nearly three times as many people the opportunity to hear KMOJ's programming. The statute requires that we provide you with specific information for each program, including estimated number of listeners and other related measures. There are some areas that's really, really easy to do. We know, for example, that more than 7,500 people attended concerts that Ampers stations produced with legacy funds. We can tell you that our new amperswebsite.org has attracted 14,117 unique visitors and 48,952 page views since its relaunch in July. Facebook post results, 46,124 post views from thousands of people. And because MMN90 airs every day on all stations, we are able to estimate that it likely reaches more than 240,000 listeners each week. Unfortunately, it's significantly more difficult to get accurate data for the legacy programs that are broadcast on air. The majority of Amper stations don't have access to any form of official audience measurement. And those that do don't have the ability to get ratings information for a show or a specific segment that only airs once. But we do know that the legacy funds have helped bring significantly more arts and cultural programs to Minnesotans. And here's how we know that. While the majority of Amper's programs are hyper-local, there are times when another Amper station or a handful of stations may want to air a program produced by another station. Now we have that infrastructure in place to be able to share these programs. It significantly increases the number of Minnesotans who have access to them. Here's a specific example. In May, KAXE, which has an estimated weekly audience of approximately 15,000 people, shared a story the station had produced about a Minnesota band. KFAI in the Twin Cities, KMSU in Mankato, and KSRQ in Thief River Falls then downloaded and aired that segment. Those three stations have a combined weekly audience estimated around 37,000 people. The result? Legacy funds help this Minnesota artist reach at least twice as many people. This multiplier effect happened 1,272 times last year, adding tens of thousands of listeners to music, arts, culture, history, and nature programs who otherwise would not be able to hear these stories, concerts, and documentaries.
Mr. Chairman, we've been asked to provide this committee with feedback on how the process has worked. From our perspective, we have to say it actually works very well. Our contacts at the Department of Administration are absolutely fantastic. Initially, there was some concern about being asked to outline in detail how we were going to spend money for the next 2 years, especially given the fact that we had less than a month to do so. We were concerned that some programs might not pan out, or that we may have better programs come up that we wouldn't be able to do because they weren't in the initial plan. But the Department of Administration developed a concept of a work plan. It allows us to make changes without having to amend the actual contract. That has worked wonderfully. It's our hope that moving forward, we will continue to have that kind of flexibility so that we can provide the very best programming possible. The forms and reports requested are straightforward and very easy to understand. The first payment from the state was significantly delayed back in 2009. That delay did cause some minor problems. Without the funds on hand, some of the stations weren't able to start the programming until fourth quarter of 2009, and as a result, some of the programs then got pushed into the next fiscal year, which created the need for funding then to be pushed into the next fiscal year. But again, the Department of Administration worked closely with us to solve that problem. Let's wrap things up with some exciting employment news. All 11 stations and Ampers itself have hired additional staff as a result of the legacy funds. The money that Ampers received helped to employ a total of 83 people in some capacity. We should point out that this number is slightly different from our formal report, and the reason for that is one of the stations reported in full-time equivalents rather than actual numbers. So in our summary today, we went ahead and adjusted that for actual employees. The funds allowed us to create one full-time position, 31 part-time opportunities, and a total of 51 contract jobs. Again, Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time. Thank you for providing us the funds that allow us to deliver more quality programming to the citizens of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your report. We have time for maybe one or two questions if they're short. But I, as I mentioned, do have the state archaeologist here, and this we can't go over today because we have session at 4:30, so I have to make sure that he gets some time today. Any quick question? You did a good job. Thank you. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you both. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Mr. Anfinson. Please identify yourself.
My name is Scott Anfinson. I'm the state archaeologist for Minnesota.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would like to thank the chair and the committee for inviting me to participate today. And I do apologize for being a little late, but I was meeting with some of our legacy contractors. And the third thing I should apologize for is my appearance, but they seem to trust me more if I dress like an archaeologist and don't wear a tie. So,
as long as you didn't bring your shovel.
I didn't. It's in my car. Yeah. I just want to also assure the committee that, Mr. Chair and members, that what I'm doing here today is really complementing and supplementing what the Minnesota Historical Society presented in their excellent presentation yesterday. I can't outdo their video, even though I appeared in it, and their really well-produced report. And so this really complements and supplements that. And I would like to say the reason I'm doing it is because this was a separate line item in the appropriation, and I felt that there was a need. And I also noticed last week during the committee hearing I attended on Wednesday that you are particularly interested in detail, and I thought I should provide you with some more detail on the actual survey. So all I'll do, I'll be very brief. I think if I just read the names, the way this was set up by the legislature was the funds went to the Minnesota Historical Society for a statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites, but the society served as the fiscal agent, but there was the legislature set up an oversight board made up of me, a representative of the Historical Society, and a representative of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and we made the decisions as to where the money should go and monitoring the contracts, and it had to go out in contracts. And I think all I need to really do, and then open it up for questions, is just read the names of the eight contracts that we have implemented, and all eight are underway. I was meeting with one of the contractors this afternoon, the last one. And if I read those, then I'll just open it up to the committee for any questions. So here are the ones in the order that we signed the contracts. Survey to assess the status of burial mound sites in Scott and Crow Wing counties. And for that, we used LIDAR and had some good results. Survey to identify and evaluate Indian sacred sites and traditional cultural properties in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. An archaeological survey of Swift County. An archaeological survey of Olmsted County, an archaeological survey of the Lake Superior Basin, a survey to find Minnesota's earliest archaeological sites, investigating unrecorded historic cemeteries in Minnesota, and the age of Brainerd ceramics. And they will all be completed in June of 2011. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? I'll just say, Mr. Anfinson, that I think this is good work that you're doing. I do, as you know, own a state archaeological site that you were last at in 1941. And if you care to come back and visit, we'd be happy to have you.
I would. Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to come out there, and I think I sent you some information.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Is it 21ME5 is the site number? Maybe?
Yes.
Meeker stands for Meeker County. And I do think Meeker County is one of the areas in general, Mr. Chair, in the state that we need to do more work in general. Meeker and Candy, Ohio are kind of at the top of my list right now because no one's really ever dug an archaeological site in those two counties. And we need more information.
Well, thank you. And I'll just conclude by saying that on the west side of Long Lake in western Meeker County, I live on the east side of Long Lake. But there is a, we've now actually identified the battlefield site of the Battle of Acton, which no one's really ever paid any attention to. So we have a basically untouched battlefield site.
And Mr. Chair, I should also mention that in the unrecorded cemeteries project we're doing, the contractor will be looking at unrecorded burials from the U.S. Dakota War. We're going to make a real attempt to sort of find out where those might be and see if we can delineate them on some maps so they can maybe not be disturbed and certainly be acknowledged.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much and for the update. And then what happens after June when we have the surveys in?
I want to build on those surveys. I know that we were a little frustrated, Representative Murphy and Chair Erdahl, that like with the LIDAR information we did, we had to use proprietary data that had been received by a couple of counties because we didn't have the statewide information yet. And now we're getting really statewide information because of the DNR and MnGeo program. And I would love to use some of that information to do another LIDAR survey of mounds using really good data. So and then we want to get this out. I will be putting this on my webpage as soon as we get the reports in so archaeologists in Minnesota can see the actual work as soon as possible. And I should have the three completed reports on my webpage within a few weeks, and this report and then the other ones as they come in.
Pretty exciting.
It is.
Thank you. Anything else? Well, then, members, we are adjourned.